From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Countdown for the Patriot Act. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The NSA's bulk collection of Americans' phone records is due to expire June 1st if Congress can't agree on a set of reforms. Republican leaders in the Senate want to keep surveillance as is. House lawmakers are trying to scale back the government's power. If phone companies take over the data collection for the NSA, will the nation be less secure? A look at the future of spying. Also today, Newton's Apple, Galileo, and the Leaning Tower of Pisa. Why myths like these about the evolution of science harm us more than you might think. The real story on how humans went from living in trees to understanding the cosmos. First News.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage on our mobile app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
This is To the Point. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Warren Olney. Just ahead, a turning point for spying. Will Congress renew or reform disputed provisions in the Patriot Act, including the bulk collection of phone records? And later on our talking point, myth-making and the history of science. How stories like Newton's apple keep us from developing a more sophisticated approach to scientific controversies facing us today. And that's all coming up. First, this news update, though. Last night and this morning, a massive storm system hammered parts of Oklahoma, Texas, and northern Mexico, causing at least 22 deaths, devastating floods, power outages, and leaving dozens missing or stranded. Houston, the fourth largest city in the U.S., has been hit with 11 inches of rain so far, forcing a citywide shutdown of schools and transit systems. At least three people have died, and roads around the region are littered with hundreds of abandoned vehicles, hampering first responders. Eric Austin is the digital news editor at KERA, a public radio station in Dallas-Fort Worth, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So what's the scene on the streets right now where you are in Dallas?
Well, in Dallas, you know, we've received a lot of rain over the past several weeks, although certainly not to the extent that Houston has received overnight. But there's been flooding throughout the state, also in Austin over the weekend between Austin and San Antonio, an area called Hill Country, very picturesque area filled with bed and breakfasts and charming, quaint towns. And there are rivers in those areas that have been soaked with water over the past few weeks, and then over the weekend just couldn't take on any more water with a bunch of flooding happening in towns like Wimberley and San Marcos, which again in Hill Country between Austin and San Antonio. But then overnight, the attention shifts to Houston with this incredible amount of rain, up to 11 inches in some areas. The streets there are flooded as we speak in much of the city.
Right. Houston's emergency management coordinator described the city as a madhouse earlier this morning. Have they been able to restore any order?
Well, the schools remain closed, as you say. They'll remain closed until tomorrow, at least. Harris County has told folks who are not essential to stay home. Emergency officials, the mayor, the governor, practically everyone who is in charge of some sort of government, they're encouraging folks to stay home because of the floodwaters. Now, the entire city is not inundated with floodwater. There are areas that are just fine, but the areas that are worst right now are central and southwest Houston. The concern in Houston and also throughout the state is that people think that they can drive through a little bit of water, and you just can't. This has been seen repeatedly over the past few weeks, not just in Houston, but also in Dallas and Austin, where motorists are just trying to drive through and venture through, and they get stuck. Even a few inches of water can really cause problems with a lot of high water rescues that become dramatic scenes with helicopters hovering overhead trying to rescue these folks. So emergency officials in Houston right now are encouraging people to stay home. They're saying, turn around, don't drown. A lot of these highways, side streets, all sorts of streets across Houston are experiencing a lot of water or flooding right now.
Well, how well prepared were city and state officials in Texas for this kind of rain, for this kind of onslaught?
You know, it's the weather's been the news in Texas for many weeks now, especially northern Texas in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, with literally almost every day now we've been seeing rain over the past few weeks. This is mainly credited to El Nino, which has been bringing rain to the southern part of the country, but especially Texas. So folks in Houston certainly knew what was happening. Rain was in the forecast. Rain continues to be in the forecast. The problem, though, in Houston in particular is that you have bayous, you know, these collections of water that normally have water in them. And but what happens is when you have all this water, 11 inches in 24 hours, even you know, normal bodies of water just can't handle that. And then you extend that to the rivers and in the hill country, and even rivers and lakes up here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area just continue to see constant flooding. So this has definitely been in the news. It's been top of mind. But, you know, some people have been found dead in the Houston area. One person found dead in a flooded pickup along Interstate 45. Another body floating in a bayou. Houston fire crews have been rescuing folks overnight and throughout the morning hours, and a couple of people reportedly have been washed away from one of those rescues. So there are several bodies, several people unaccounted for right now.
And is this situation, the rescue attempts, is it complicated by people who are taking out boats just to explore the flooding?
Definitely. Crews don't want people messing around right now. Emergency crews want people at home so that they're safe, so that they too don't get, capsized in a boating situation. Even experienced boaters can't necessarily handle all of this flood water. And also the concern is downed power lines and, you know, possibly being electrocuted. 80,000 power outages overnight, down to 50,000 power outages now. But authorities in Houston are encouraging folks to stay about 10 feet away from these downed power lines and to leave natural gas valves alone. So there are lots of concerns that could hamper rescue efforts, not just boaters, but just folks, staying away from power lines is a key issue right now down there.
And just very briefly, looking ahead, how much rain is in the forecast and how far is this storm system expected to reach?
Rain is in the forecast practically every day in the Houston area, every day in the Austin area, and for several days in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. We could see several more inches, and these rain-choked bayous and lakes and rivers that can't handle any more water will just have to have more water with more flooding expected for the next several days.
Eric Austin, digital news editor at KERW Public Radio Station in Dallas-Fort Worth, thank you so much for taking the time to update us.
Oh, sure. Thank you.
And take care. When we come back, the Patriot Act on the chopping block. Key provisions of the nation's post-9/11 surveillance program are set to expire at the end of the month if the Senate doesn't act. Stay with us for that conversation on To the Point.
KCRW's Eclectic 24 is our ever-expanding all-music stream, featuring the best new releases, classic favorites, and special features, including today's top tune, guest DJ project, and KCRW archives. Listen worldwide anytime online or through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out at kcrw.com/eclectic24.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
And we're back with To the Point. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Warren Olney. It's countdown time for the Patriot Act. On June 1st, some of the NSA programs launched after 9/11 are due to expire. That is, unless the Senate can agree on how much of the surveillance program to preserve. The Senate is scrambling to negotiate a compromise this week after failing to come to a vote before the recess. The House voted overwhelmingly to reauthorize the Patriot Act, while at the same time ending the NSA's bulk collection of phone records. The House also approved certain reforms intended to make the agency's programs more transparent. And here to explain the divide in Congress is Julian Haddam, national security and politics reporter for The Hill, and it's good to have you on the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Now, before we get to the politics of what happened over the weekend, can we just back up and get our terms straight? Exactly what security programs are set to expire on June 1st?
Sure. At the end of the month, three parts of the Patriot Act are set to run out. Included among those is this controversial provision known as Section 215. This authorizes the NSA, or the NSA has used it to authorize a bulk sweeping collection of phone records about millions of Americans without a warrant. This was a big program that was revealed by Edward Snowden about 2 years ago and has been really controversial. It's kind of epitomized for a lot of people, kind of overreach of government surveillance agencies, and has been a target for a lot of civil libertarians looking to rein it in and using this expiration of this law as a chance to make that happen and to extract some real changes from the NSA.
And so in the big picture, is this the heart of the Patriot Act?
It's certainly not the heart of the Patriot Act. It's one of many provisions of that law and one of many tools that the NSA and the FBI say that they have in their toolbox. But it's nonetheless, they say, a very important tool and one that essentially allows them to connect the dots between terrorists is how they like to frame it. And in addition to the NSA, it also gives a lot of powers to the FBI. And as addition to that singular provision of the law, Section 215, there are two other provisions of the Patriot Act set to run out. One of them authorizes the government to go after what's called lone wolf, suspected lone wolf terrorists or possible foreign spies. And another one allows them to track suspected terrorists or foreign spies who might be using through what's called burner cell phones. So they switch from phone to phone to phone. This is something that's common for criminal cases, but not necessarily legally supported for counterterrorism and counterintelligence operations, except for in this Patriot Act provision. So there's been this big back and forth about whether to renew the law, whole hog, just to keep it currently unchanged and give the NSA and the FBI these powers without reforming them, or, as a number of civil libertarians in both parties have said, they should renew the law, but changing them to limit the NSA and to add more transparency, as you measured, for a lot of their programs, and to prevent them from collecting just sweeping amounts of data about millions of people.
Which is what the House did in improving a reform bill called the USA Freedom Act. So, to bring us up to date, when the Senate met last week, Senator Rand Paul staged something just short of an official filibuster. He spoke against the Patriot Act for nearly 11 hours. Let's hear a snippet of his speech on the Senate floor.
There comes a time in the history of nations when fear and complacency allow power to accumulate and liberty and privacy to suffer. That time is now. And I will not let the Patriot Act, the most unpatriotic of acts, go unchallenged.
Okay, the most unpatriotic of acts. What was the reaction in the Senate to Paul's rant and to the House's USA Freedom Act proposal?
Noting, it's very worth pointing out here that Rand Paul is running for president, and this is very much, this helps to increase his political profile in the early days of the 2016 presidential primary. But yeah, it really had a pretty big interaction, a pretty big impact. A lot of Democrats and a couple of Republicans joined him there on the Senate floor at one point in the course of his 10.5-hour speech, saying that, yes, you know, you're right, a lot of these Patriot Act provisions are gross and unwarranted and go beyond the letter of the law. Senator Rand Paul was also very buoyed in that his speech came just a few days or a week or two after a major appeals court ruling up in New York. The Second Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the NSA's bulk phone records program that is at the heart of this debate was actually illegal and went beyond what the Patriot Act allowed it to do. And there's some other court cases that are currently working their way through here. But he got a lot of pressure. He got a lot of publicity and a lot of FaceTime for this massive 10.5-hour speech, which was not technically a filibuster, but still, you know, vaulted this issue, which I think a lot of people have kind of forgotten about in the last couple of years. It put it back on the headlines, and it made him a major player in this conversation over whether and how to move forward with the Patriot Act.
And how did Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell respond to the unofficial filibuster?
Sure.
He's a hawk. He would like to see the Patriot Act reauthorized as is, and that's the power struggle going on.
Yeah, absolutely. So Mitch McConnell does not want any changes to the Patriot Act. He thinks that it's great as is, and it should continue if not get stronger. But he's in an awkward position here because Mitch McConnell is also from Kentucky, as is Rand Paul. And they, during Mitch McConnell's reelection a couple years ago, they had kind of a bromance, some people said. They, you know, campaigned together. McConnell's and Paul were often at the same stops and spoke together. And McConnell even gave Rand Paul, like an early endorsement of sorts for his White House bid. So they're very tied together, but on this issue, they are very, very, very far apart. And McConnell has basically said, like, I don't agree with Rand Paul. I think he's very wrong here. And there was a very interesting bit of political tension and political drama that happened over the weekend when they went into late voting early on Saturday morning. I think they wrapped up around 2 a.m. At one point, Mitch McConnell said, okay, we had this back and forth on how to move forward. Let's extend the current law for just a week or maybe 5 days or two or three days so that we can get through this current recess. And then when the House comes back to Washington, we can all talk together and figure out a way forward. And Rand Paul stood up and said, no, I object. I refuse to make this happen. So this is certainly creating a bit of tension between the two, between McConnell and Paul, and that tension is only going to increase as we continue going and as negotiations work on through the week to try and hammer out a deal, and then into next weekend when they're supposed to meet in a rare Sunday session, Sunday evening, to try and figure out a game plan with just a couple of hours to go before the law, these provisions of the law at least, run out at midnight on Sunday evening.
Julian Haddam, national security and politics reporter for The Hill. Jamil Jaffer joins us now. He's deputy legal director of the ACLU. And earlier this month, the ACLU filed the suit that Julian Haddam was referencing against the government's phone data collection under Section 215. The Federal Appeals Court in New York ruled in favor of the ACLU, saying that the bulk phone collection went overboard and was unlawful. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So with this bromance between Senator Mitch McConnell and Rand Paul on the skids, what do you think is going to happen with the Senate negotiations this week?
Well, I wish I knew. I mean, I can tell you what I think should happen. Right now, there are a bunch of different camps here. One camp is Mitch McConnell's camp that wants to essentially keep the law as it is. And then there are people on the other side of the spectrum who think that these provisions should sunset altogether. And then there are some people in between who think that some form of reform is possible and necessary. You know, we have been hoping from the beginning that Congress would coalesce around far-reaching reforms to the surveillance laws. This is, in a way, a kind of unique opportunity with these three provisions set to sunset on June 1st. And we had hoped that Congress would seize that opportunity to reform not just those three provisions, but other surveillance authorities as well. But the reform bill that's currently on the table, the USA Freedom Act, is very limited. Even its proponents, I think, acknowledge that. And given the choice now between reform of that kind or a sunset, we think sunset is the better course. Now, sunset wouldn't accomplish the kind of reform, far-reaching reform that we think needs to be accomplished, but it would be a first step in that direction. Now we're just a few days away from it, and it looks more and more likely.
Well, the ACLU partnered with the Tea Party group to pressure Congress into not renewing this, metadata collection program. So does this issue go way beyond partisan politics?
Yeah, I think this is one of the really interesting things here is that, I use the phrase across the spectrum just now, which is not really the right phrase, because there are conservatives and progressives and libertarians and core Republicans who believe that these authorities should be scaled back. We did a poll. The ACLU hired two polling firms, one associated with the Republicans and another associated with the Democrats, to do polling on this issue. And the results were that about 80% of Americans said that they were at least somewhat concerned about the government surveillance activities, and about 60% believe that the Patriot Act should be scaled back in some ways. And that 60% comes from progressives on the left, from libertarians on the right, and from independents. It really is quite remarkable how widespread the feeling is that government surveillance has gone too far.
Jamil Jaffer, deputy legal director of the ACLU. Timothy Edgar joins the conversation now. He's a visiting fellow at Brown University's Watson Institute for International Studies. He worked with both the Bush and Obama administrations, where he was the first privacy director at the National Security Council under Obama. Welcome.
Hi, it's good to be here.
So explain to us, first of all, what does the USA Freedom Act, this reform package the House is proposing, what does it do? And is it as limited as our guest Jamil Jaffer just argued?
No, I don't think it's as limited. And I also think it's critically important to show that Congress can engage on this issue and pass surveillance reforms. And if it sunsetted, if this bill just sunsetted without a viable alternative for collecting metadata, I think it would be very bad for national security. So I think it's actually critically important that the USA Freedom Act pass in the next week or so. And it's important for national security, and it's an opportunity for a first step in favor of surveillance reform.
So are you saying this reform is good that the House has proposed, and that it institutes the right constraints that would satisfy privacy and civil liberties concerns?
Yes. Well, already there are constraints on the collection of metadata and the analysis of metadata by the NSA. The big problem is that the NSA keeps all of this metadata in a vast repository, subject to court-ordered constraints for how it can analyze it. What the USA Freedom Act does is it leaves that metadata with the phone companies, but then gives the NSA the ability to query it very quickly and with a great deal of agility. And that's very important when you're dealing with fast-moving threats like ISIS, encouraging homegrown terrorism. The NSA needs to be able to take a suspect number and ping it against the phone company's database and see how far out those contacts go very quickly. And if you just let the whole provision sunset, you're not only going to get rid of the bulk collection, which I think all of us agree should be narrowed, but you're going to get rid of that ability to query metadata in an efficient way.
Well, why is data safer with the phone companies than with the government?
That's a good question, but I think that the biggest concern around bulk collection has been just Americans are uncomfortable with the NSA having a database of millions of Americans' metadata. Even though there are lots of safeguards that the court has imposed on how analysts can query that data, that really does require that we have a certain amount of trust in the NSA. And even if we think the NSA is mostly doing the right thing and that those safeguards have worked, what about 20 years from now? What about 10 years from now? And then on a pragmatic level, Jamil has been very successful. The courts have thrown out bulk collection under the existing language. So even if Senator McConnell prevailed and this Patriot Act was reauthorized without change, I think a lot of people in the intelligence community think that would be a Pyrrhic victory because they would end up losing that case in court. They'd much rather have a narrower and more solid surveillance authority, which they would get under the USA Freedom Act.
Timothy Edgar with Brown University's Watson Institute for International Studies. Jamil Jaffer, deputy with the ACLU. Why not reform this surveillance program, bearing in mind the threat we face from ISIS now?
You know, I actually agree with most of what Tim just said. I mean, I do think that the government should have the authority to engage in targeted collection. And for that reason, you know, we would prefer to reform these authorities rather than, you know, that would be our first choice, certainly. The problem with the reform proposal that's on the table right now is that while it would prevent the government from conducting bulk collection of phone records, it doesn't really prevent the government from engaging in bulk or at least bulky collection of other kinds of records. And our concern is that by passing this kind of legislation, you may get rid of this phone records program, but you may end up creating a lot of other programs, a lot of other broad surveillance programs that we may never find out about. So that's the concern with it. But I actually agree with Tim that, you know, the government should have the authority to engage in targeted collection. Now, it has other authorities, you know, quite apart from these Patriot Act authorities that it can use to engage in that kind of targeted collection. And I think that if Section 215 were to sunset, what the government would do is it would engage in targeted collection under, for example, the Pen Register Authority or the National Security Letter Authority or any one of a dozen administrative subpoena authorities that the government can use in terrorism and other national security investigations. So,
and we're going to talk about that in the second half of our conversation. Jamil Jaffer with the ACLU. We'll continue our conversation after a short break about NSA surveillance and the Patriot Act, and later on our talking point, how scientific myths like Newton's apple warp our understanding of the complexity of science. That's coming up on To the Point from PRI.
Browse the KCRW store and shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and merchandise. Shop to support KCRW only at kcrw.com/store.
It's To the Point. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Warren Olney. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about key provisions of the NSA's surveillance programs under the Patriot Act that are due to expire on June 1st if the Senate doesn't act to keep them in place or reform them. Senate leaders are trying to come to an agreement with House lawmakers who voted to limit the government's ability to collect massive amounts of phone metadata. Scott Shane joins us now. He's the national security reporter for The New York Times. And thanks for taking the time to come on our program.
Glad to be with you.
Well, we haven't talked much about Edward Snowden yet in this show, and he's, of course, the NSA security contractor who leaked hundreds of thousands of highly classified documents to the press. But it's safe to say, is it, without Snowden and his revelations about this massive data collection program, that we might not even be seeing this kind of battle in Congress about the Patriot Act?
I think that is fair to say. There were rumors going around about how Section 215 of the Patriot Act was being used, and certain members of Congress, in particular Senator Ron Wyden, had dropped some hints that there were, that he was unhappy with it. But a number of us, journalists, actually worked pretty hard to try and find out what it was, and we really did not nail it until Edward Snowden made those documents available. What's remarkable, that was almost exactly 2 years ago, and what's remarkable is this sort of parallel process. You have Snowden, who has been charged with very serious crimes, espionage and theft of government property, and potentially faces a very long prison term and is essentially stuck in Russia where his with a suspended U.S. passport. That's all happening on the one hand. On the other hand, as has been discussed, a court has ruled that this program, the way it's been carried out, is illegal. And you have Congress in the middle of this very heated debate about ending some of the, government powers that that Snowden was anxious to expose. So it's pretty unusual situation.
Well, has Snowden fundamentally changed how we think about privacy and the internet and government surveillance? And is it more a factor, less a factor of what exactly was in the documents that he released, that he leaked, as the fact that the story ignited this debate and had got people thinking about surveillance at all?
Well, I think he has had an historic effect on how people see government surveillance and simply the powers that technology now gives governments to keep an eye on foreign countries or, in some circumstances, American citizens. Going back in the history of the National Security Agency, there used to be, some decades ago, rail cars filled with magnetic tape that no one at NSA had ever listened to, and they were sort of overwhelmed by the amount of information they were collecting back then. But now, as anyone who uses Google knows, you can go through an immense amount of data in a big hurry. So I think what Snowden revealed is how technology that has changed everybody's lives has changed NSA's life. And, the difference is that NSA operates pretty much in the dark. And so all of a sudden people learned what this agency was doing with our money and in our name. And that has, it turned out, deeply divided Americans. I mean, I think a lot of Americans are ambivalent about it. They want to be protected against terrorism, and people are reading every day about the horrors of ISIS. And at the same time, they're, somewhat worried about Big Brother and about the government collecting all their phone call logs.
And does his influence cascade beyond how people think about the internet and national and government surveillance to how people within the intelligence community think about the gathering of intelligence?
Well, after every terrorist attack, Think about the shootings at Fort Hood or the Boston Marathon bomb, or certainly 9/11. We in the press are immediately digging into how the government missed the signs and suggesting they should have connected the dots, they should have looked at the data. But then those kinds of fears fade, we in the press focus on the potential that the government may abuse these powers of collecting data and looking into it. So I think sometimes the intelligence community, the intelligence agencies, feel a little whipsawed by public opinion. It's interesting, this particular issue does not break down along partisan lines. A lot of Democrats and Republicans are on both sides of this issue, and I think in that sense it really does reflect difficulty that Americans often have deciding what they want from the government on this count.
Scott Shane is a national security reporter for the New York Times. Jamil Jaffer is with the ACLU. He's their deputy legal director. You hosted a Reddit discussion last week with Edward Snowden. What questions came up that you found interesting?
Well, people asked him the obvious questions about his views of the debate that's going on right now. I think that it's one of his concerns, and it's certainly one of our concerns too, is the extent to which the current debate is unique because of the disclosure. So, as Scott says, there's a lot we didn't know until Snowden disclosed all this information a couple of years ago and the Washington Post and the Guardian published it. But now we know and we can address the things that he disclosed. But what happens, 2 years from now or 5 years from now or 10 years from now when other programs like this are developed once again in secret? What institutional mechanisms are in place to prevent those kinds of programs from sort of growing out of control in the same way that the call records program has grown out of control? And that's one of the reasons, I think, why far-reaching reform is so necessary. We don't need just sort of marginal new limits on the government surveillance activities. We need institutional changes to make sure that these kinds of programs are kept in check next time around.
Jamil Jaffer, Deputy Legal Director of the ACLU. Timothy Edgar is a visiting fellow at Brown University's Watson Institute for International Studies. Do we need institutional changes?
Yes, absolutely. But I think that Jamil may understate the degree to which we've had many institutional changes. You can go on the website of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, a new website called IC on the Record, and read thousands of pages of declassified documents about programs that were classified at the very highest levels when I was in the government. That's a big change. Even in terms of this debate, this is not actually the first time that Congress will have debated bulk collection under Section 215 of the Patriot Act. It's reauthorized it twice. It had a debate in secret about that program because in the late half of the second half of the Bush administration, we put a lot of effort into ensuring that Congress was briefed on these programs. Many programs right after 9/11 were held much too closely in the office of the president, and people were not read into them. So I guess I'm giving a little bit of the glass half full point here, but the fact is that we have some of the most robust safeguards for privacy and civil liberties of any country in the world on intelligence activities. And we also have dramatically more transparency around these activities than any other country or even than we had just a few years ago. And certainly Snowden was part of that, but I don't think he was the only reason that we have many of these reforms.
And speaking to Snowden and the shift in public opinion, or perhaps the perceived shift in public opinion about his legitimacy and legitimacy of his leaks or his whistleblower status, what do you make of that? You're at Brown University. He's been speaking at places like Princeton and Stanford.
Well, look, I think that you can separate a little bit the benefits of having a debate about surveillance reform from the personal decision of somebody who had a security clearance to basically violate the terms of that clearance and put out a lot of highly sensitive information. The things that most people that I know in the intelligence community are most worried about aren't some of the big issues that we're debating now, which maybe should have been transparent, but things about the details of where NSA installations are or exactly which particular techniques are used for breaking into systems. And some of that leaking did real damage to the national security. So I don't think you can look at Snowden as only, you know, a hero and champion of surveillance reform. I think you also have to look at the damage that his activities have done to the national security in engaging in unauthorized leaks that were really quite serious.
Timothy Edgar with Brown University's Watson Institute for International Studies. Julian Haddam is national security and politics reporter for The Hill. Looking at all the players, it is interesting to me that the heads of the security agencies say that they want reform too. Why and what do they want?
Absolutely. I mean, this has been a priority of President Obama for the last year or so. He said that there's a real trust gap between the public and a lot of these intelligence agencies. A lot of people have grown really suspicious of them, and that's bad for kind of the fundamental trust in the government. It's also, to some extent, bad for American businesses. A lot of Edward Snowden's revelations have really damaged, especially American tech companies. Foreign competitors, foreign workers are saying that they don't want to work or buy from American tech companies because they're going to send everything to the NSA, which is not necessarily true, but it has created this damaging impact. And in order to repair that trust and to kind of move forward and to bridge some of these divides, which are not necessarily partisan, but have, you know, left things like the future of these Patriot Act provisions in doubt, they say that there should be, you know, meaningful and kind of purposeful reforms made. So the Obama administration worked very hard and spent a lot of time working on this reform bill in Congress called the USA Freedom Act. It's got support from the Attorney General, the Director of National Intelligence, a couple of other folks. And they want to see this get done. The president just this morning actually said that, you know, the Senate needs to get back to work and finalize this and make sure that there is not a lapse in the law by the time it happens. And we'll see if they take him up on that word or not.
Julian Haddam, national security and politics reporter for The Hill. Scott Shane with The New York Times, covering national security as well. Can we broaden, just to put a final note on the Snowden conversation, how has his influence impacted tech companies? Is that what we're seeing with the increased encryption on the part of Apple and Google?
Yeah, I think a lot of people in Silicon Valley, though they're very sophisticated, obviously, on these technical subjects, were shocked to find out what NSA was doing. To sort of summarize, NSA was working with them on the front end with warrants and that sort of thing, but also they found out it was working secretly on the back end, invading their communications in various ways. And they were very worried about they were outraged by that, and they were also very worried about their customers getting very wary that they were in league with the government. So Apple, Google, and other companies have started adding much tougher encryption to some of their equipment and some of their operations. And, there's a real fight that's going on now between whether the government should have the right and the ability to get stuff under some circumstances, or whether the company should be able to say, you know what, that's encrypted, we don't have the key, and, you'll have to find some other way to get at it. And that applies to, the FBI in particular has been complaining about the possibility of communications that it wants to tap into, so-called going dark.
And we raise this issue of whether the phone companies hold on to the data or the government, who then pings the phone companies. What about data storage of this bulk collection? What's the consensus on the safety and the security of that?
Well, we all hear about, data leaks and data break-ins all the time, so it's hard to be completely sanguine about that. I mean, what's happened is that, as everybody knows, who's ever used a thumb drive, you know, the price of data storage has just dropped precipitously, and you can store an enormous amount of data in a small space, and you can search it. That's a huge temptation for these government agencies that we ask to, you know, keep track of terrorist threats and other things. You know, those technologies are only going in one direction. It's going to be easier and easier for the government to collect and store and search more and more data.
And just moving beyond the physical challenges of storing data, what's the consensus on the risk of just not renewing, of letting this lapse, Section 215, the bulk data collection? How critical is it to national security?
Well, you know, generally speaking, the government has been hard-pressed to find examples in which this particular authority, the Patriot Act 215 provision and collection of phone records, has stopped terrorist attacks. They really haven't been able to come up with anything like that. But they are, you know, but I think they're sincerely concerned about losing it. They believe that in the future, you know, you could see a terrorist attack that could have been prevented with this kind of proceeding that, you know, might go ahead if they don't have it.
Scott Shane with the New York Times. Timothy Edgar with Brown University's Watson Institute for International Studies. Is that true? Are we lacking examples of how Section 215 has helped national security?
Well, there's a broad impression of that, and I think that's overstated. And I think the reason is because we're using too high a standard when we talk about looking at intelligence activities. There's rarely an example where one particular piece of intelligence is going to show you that it's the be-all and end-all of stopping a terrorist attack. What the government has shown is that this authority has been used in several specific examples of terrorist attacks, terrorist incidents, including terrorist incidents in the homeland. It's been helpful in those incidents. There have been other intelligence that's gathered as well. And I think you're going to see that's true with a lot of different kinds of intelligence authorities. You know, you can't necessarily point to one particular, you know, whether it's metadata or the content of a particular call or human intelligence, there's a pattern that you're trying to knit together. And if you look at one program and say, not only has it been helpful, which it has been in this case, the metadata has clearly been helpful in some of these attacks, but has it been, you know, if we took away this one power, would you have also been able to solve it? Well, yes, in those cases, they could have, but I think that's just the wrong standard for analysis.
And now we're going to have to wait to see where Congress takes this. I want to thank all of you, Timothy Edgar with Brown University's Watson Institute for International Studies, Jamil Jaffer, Deputy Legal Director of the ACLU and Director of its Center for Democracy, Julian Haddam, National Security and Politics Reporter for The Hill, and Scott Shane with The New York Times. Thanks again for taking the time to talk with me today. Appreciate it. In a moment, everything you thought you knew about the great discoveries in science, well, it's probably wrong. Revisiting how humans went from living in trees to splitting atoms. That's next. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from PRI.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
I'm Barbara Bogave, and for Warren Olney with today's talking point, Newton's apple, Darwin's bird studies on the voyage of the Beagle, Galileo and the Leaning Tower of Pisa. I bet you learned those stories in school about the origins of the theory of gravity, natural selection, and motion. I certainly did. And they made science class fun, or almost fun. But according to Leonard Mlodinow, not only are these stories not true, they misrepresent the real nature of scientific discovery and evolution in very destructive ways. Mlodinow is a theoretical physicist and the author of the new book Upright Thinkers, The Human Journey from Living in Trees to Understanding the Cosmos. He's also co-author with Stephen Hawking of The Grand Design. And it's such a pleasure to have you on the show today.
Great to be here, Barbara.
Well, let's reel back to the earliest origins of science, because I always thought that early humans gave up being nomads to live together communally because that way of life was easier and because they figured out agriculture, and that the science came before this change in culture. But you say it was the other way around, that this is significant.
science really came after, and what you've been taught about the so-called agricultural revolution isn't really true. When we go back and look at the remains of nomadic peoples who lived just before the agricultural revolution and compare those to the remains of the farmers, who the first farmers, we find that the nomads were better nourished, lived longer, had fewer diseases, and had a more varied diet. So the settling down and the beginnings of agriculture actually formed a much harder life for people than what we had before.
So why'd we do it? And what evidence is there?
Well, a lot of people think today that we did it for spiritual reasons. People around that time started asking existential questions. Why are we here? What is the universe like? How was nature created? And they built the first temples, and they started to wonder what happened after death, and they wanted to keep their departed loved ones with them. And when you're a nomad, you can't do that. You leave people to die in the wild when they get old and sick, and you can't carry their bodies with you. But in the first settlements, they essentially buried their dead under the floorboards, and they lived on top of them.
Oh, interesting. So what does this say about the evolution of science? Interesting and kind of scary, actually, what you just said. But in terms of the evolution...
Hey, Grandma's two stories down.
I guess it's not that unusual. But did science evolve because of something innate in us that we ask the question why, instead of maybe the other path, which is that it was practical, solved practical,
no, exactly.
gave
we
us
began
practical
to ask,
solutions?
Well, we began to ask, what is the meaning of life? And that led to all sorts of why questions. And when we study humans now and compare humans to other animals and other primates in experiments, we find that humans are by far the most curious species. And our curiosity and even our knowledge about the world begins at a very early age, even while we're still young infants.
Oh, those baby studies are fascinating, right? You found that in babies, they have an innate sense of the natural properties of the universe, of kind of a basic physics.
Right. When Newton formulated Newton's laws, he wasn't really inventing making a new observation as much as he was expressing what even infants know. There have been studies on infants as young as 6 months where they show them situations. And it's hard to know what an infant is thinking. I have three kids, teenage years and beyond, and they can all speak English very well, and I still don't know what they're thinking. But with infants, it turns out that you can tell one thing very clearly. That's when they're surprised. An infant that's surprised at something will stare at it, whereas an infant that isn't will dart around and be curious about many things. And so scientists took these young infants and they showed them collisions of cylinders rolling down inclined planes and hitting other cylinders and bopping around and so forth. And then they arranged for some infants to see the same incidents where they somehow magically made the results of those collisions not obey Newton's laws, that is, be not what you find in nature. So they were essentially doing magician's tricks in front of the infants. And they found that the infants who saw the non-Newtonian, the world not as it is in our everyday physics, were very surprised and would stare at it for long periods of time.
Oh, it's fascinating. Well, this is skipping all the way up to Newton now, but the conventional story online on him, aside from, of course, the Newton's apple myth, which we learn in school, the storyline was that he wasted a lot of time on crazy stuff like alchemy and numerology. And is this another myth or misconception about science and the nature of scientific inquiry, that it goes in a straight line and that this stuff was like a sideways path, a distraction for him?
Well, the myth is, of course, of Newton's apple is that he saw the apple drop and got these great ideas, and that was his theory. And that's, I think, very destructive, and that's totally wrong. In fact, even by the time he was in his early 40s, he still had very little clue as to what we would today call Newton's laws or his laws of physics. And indeed, Newton did spend a lot more time on failed efforts than he ever did on physics that led somewhere, or even on physics. He spent most of his time on alchemy. He had a huge and elaborate alchemy laboratory. He owned every book that had ever been written on alchemy. And in fact, when he died, much later, when we look at his remains, we see that the concentrations of mercury in his body were about 15 times the healthy limit. And so he went down, and he wasn't, by the way, doing his alchemy to turn lead into gold or to find the elixir of life. He was really trying to invent chemistry in a sense. So it was a sort of a scientific operation, though it was definitely mixed with a lot of mysticism. But it was just a lot of dead ends and blind alleys. And this just illustrates that in science, that's what you have to do. Scientists are people who have to be comfortable with failure, and you have failure after failure after failure before you have success. So the myths aren't true. What you really have in science is a lot of failure before you ever get anywhere.
Well, don't we need the myths, though, to give us illustrations, to give us a metaphor to help us understand these complicated scientific concepts?
Not at all. I think you can certainly understand a concept without having the myth of someone discovering it in a snap. And actually, the true stories of discovery, I find, are much more inspiring than the myths, and they're tales of passion and perseverance and success at the end. So I think they make much better stories than the simplified myths.
Well, what's at stake, though, in these myths, besides that we don't understand that you have to be persistent in order to be a scientist? And I'm thinking, what are the consequences today that we've learned these stories?
Well, the myths are destructive. Because, look, if you think that Newton could look at an apple fall and come up with the laws of gravity and motion, or that Darwin could see some finches on islands and there you have evolution, then some of our politicians, you know, it makes sense when they go, oh, it's cold in Washington, there's no global warming, you know, or look at the eye of that gnat. Evolution couldn't possibly be true. So this encourages that kind of oversimplified and wrong thinking, and it makes people believe that science is simpler than it really is. But to really understand these issues, and a lot of the issues that are important in politics today, it takes years of study to comprehend what's going on a professional level. And to not understand that is destructive. It leads to wrong ideas.
Well, do you think this plays into an issue that some scientists are really concerned about these days, which is the amount of shoddy research going on now, falsification of data and small sample sizes and conflicts of interest and trendiness in what scientists choose or to research or are given funding for?
Well, you know, Barbara, scientists
I'm saying this is that the editor-in-chief of The Lancet, the world's leading medical journal, just came out with a statement exactly along these lines.
Well, yeah, yes, and in biology and especially in the social sciences, I think that's more prevalent than in the physical sciences, and it's the studies are a little bit fuzzier. But, you know, scientists are the most skeptical of people, and we really question authority, and we question new theories, and we question error. We're always worried about error, but we're also very trusting, and we believe in people's basic honesty. And one of the problems with modern science is that over the last few decades, experimental science has changed in a way that it requires a great deal of funding and a lot of people working on an experiment, so that some of the scientists, some of my friends who run labs are more like CEOs than they are scientists in the traditional sense. And they have an enormous amount of pressure to come up with quick results and to get funding, just like CEOs have pressure to have quarterly results.
Leonard Mlodinow's new book is Upright Thinkers, The Human Journey from Living in Trees to Understanding the Cosmos. And we're going to have you back on our show to talk about writing for MacGyver and Star Trek. I'm so sorry we're out of time.
There's some good stories there. Yeah.
Thanks a lot for the science and for being here. And I'm Barbara Bogave in for Warren Olney. I want to thank all of you for listening. And join us next time for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.